members, our committee member. Today we have the a presentation on the corporate excise tax, and we have Lisbeth with us. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lisbeth.
Chairman Deckard and House Committee member, or Senate Committee member. This, for the record, I'm Lisbeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. And today we're just going to go through and have a real brief overview of the corporate excise tax system. And so I'll start it off, and then I'll also have Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue will talk briefly also about nexus issues and administrative issues connected with the corporate excise tax system. Now, to just be clear, when we're talking about the corporate excise tax, this is the tax that is paid by corporations who have nexus in Oregon here. And nexus here is meaning a connection and a linkage. And basically, the nexus, it's determining the degree of business activity that must be present before a state has the right to impose a tax. So when we see the income tax numbers dealing with corporate, this is the corporate excise tax primarily. Now, the corporate income tax is paid by those corporations that don't have nexus here in Oregon, but they have corporate income. So, again, Oregon taxes the business income of businesses who are actually doing business here in Oregon, and they have a physical presence here in Oregon. Now, I'm just going to go and give you just some brief statistics on the income tax returns and, in general, business income tax returns. And I've lumped in here sole proprietors, S corporation, and farms. And these three are from the personal income tax system. And again, these three, the sole proprietors, S corporations, and farms, pay personal income tax. They do not pay a corporate excise tax. The S corporations will pay a minimum excise tax of $10, but they are not going to pay the traditional excise tax, which we'll be going through today. But it's sometimes good for you to get a broader overview of businesses in Oregon, incorporating some of these smaller businesses and comparing the numbers. So basically, as you can see, on just the number of returns in a given year, this is right here, tax year 1999, sole proprietors made up 67% of all the business income tax returns. In 1990, there were 190,072 sole proprietors. So you can see that that dominates the small businesses in the state, or the sole proprietors. Now, you see 13% were C corporations, 35,510 C corporations in 1990, and there were 36,948 farms in Oregon in 1990. And what you see, though, is that the S corporations were a very small percent, only 7% of all the business income tax returns, and there were 18,437 S corporation returns. Now, 10 years later, in 2000, what you've seen here is, you know, the sole proprietors have increased. They increased 10%. But on a percentage basis, they actually went down because they were not increasing as fast as some other business returns. So sole proprietors in 2000 were 65% of all returns. And but what you see is the real rapid growth here in S corporations. S corporations grew 132% as far as the number of returns. So they grew from only being 7% of all the returns in 1990 to in 2000 being 13% of all the returns. And farms declined slightly over that last 10 years, a decline of 5% there. As far, now, these are, again, returns that have some farm income reported on them. So the farm income went from 13% of the returns to 11% of the returns. And C corporations also rose slightly, only 2% over 10 years. So as far as the C corporations percent of the total, it went down. It went from 13% to 11%. Now, when you look at this in terms of just these number of returns, and when you look at the kind of income groups that these returns fall into, and what kind of change we've had then since 1990 versus 2000, and what you see with is quite different as far as these small businesses, the sole proprietors. They very few of those returns have negative income, have a loss. Okay, so this is basically telling you how many returns were in the loss category. And for sole proprietors in 1990 and 2000, they had very few in that loss category. And what you see is is a large portion of them there. You know, about 35% were in the 0 to 20,000 category, and that didn't change too much between 1990 and 2000. You saw in 1990, though, a big large portion of them were between 20,000 and 50,000 in income, so you have over 30% there in that income group, where that income group shrunk over 10 years. And then you saw a more of a growth then in some of the higher income groups here between the 50,000, 100,000, and the 100,000 to 500,000 group. Now, with S corporations, what we see here is that very similar to C corporations, you've got almost 40% of all those returns have a loss in their, as far as their income. And so that is something that's pretty depictive of the corporations. And then you can see there between 0 and 20,000 was a large portion there, about 30, 31% of all of the S corporations in 1990 had between 0 and 20,000. And that, you know, shrunk a bit. And again, some of the other higher income groups grew over the last 10 years for S corporations. And with farms, it's similar again, too. And again, this is total income that's reported on the returns of farm income. And here you see in 1990, there were a few farms that had negative income. But there were also, most of the farms were in this group between 20,000 and 50,000, where there was over 40%, about 43% of all of the returns were in the $20,000 to $50,000 category. And then you look over by year 2000, you see that portion of the total has shrunk slightly. And again, you see a much larger portion of the farms in 2000 being between $50,000 and $100,000 as far as their income. And with C corporations, again, what we see mainly over the last 10 years is just a growth then in these upper income groups. You can see the red there, which indicates the C corporations that have an income above 500,000. You know, that grew, you know, from hardly probably less than 1% to probably 2%. So to just kind of look at this same thing again as far as a percent of the total, but looking at the business income this time. Now, when we were looking before with returns, we saw the sole proprietors made up the majority of all the returns. Well, we can see here that in 1990, sole proprietors did not make up 67% of all the business income. Sole proprietors only made up 40% of all the business income. And the C corporations, even though they were a pretty small portion of the total, only like 30% of all the returns, they made 44% of all the business income in 1990. And farms only made up 1% of all the income, and S corporations made up 15% of all the income in 1990. Now, when you move to tax year 2000, you've seen a real big jump here in C corporations as far as the percent of the total business income. C corporations now comprise 62% of all the business income in the state. And what this is really telling you is that, yes, we do have more small businesses out there in Oregon, but what you're seeing when you look at overall total business income, the C corporations over the past 10 years, the bigger multi-state corporations, are really the ones that are beginning to pay even a higher portion of our tax. Now over 50% of the business income and ultimately the tax is paid then by these bigger corporations. And I think you see, and we'll discuss this in more detail, about some of our policies then have really begun to focus then a lot more on these multi-state issues. Now, when you look at sole proprietors, they were about 40% of the total income in 1990. And as we said before, that sole proprietors didn't grow that much over the last 10 years, only like 10% as far as the number of returns. So you see as a percent of the total, sole proprietors are only 21% of all the business income in 2000. And S corporations, even with a growth in the number of S corporations over 132%, as far as the percent of business income, they're exactly the same over the last 10 years as far as the percent of total. I mean, obviously it's gone up a billion there in income, but it, you know, the point is the other businesses have grown at a much faster rate. And farm income here, as you can see, has gotten more negative. Now I'm just going to kind of walk through some of the steps like we did before on the personal income tax side, when you look at then the business income tax statement, and this again, I'm thinking of this in terms of what is reported at the federal level by these corporations, and they first will report all of their gross receipts and sales from all the business operations. So at the federal level, they'll consolidate all the different corporations that are connected with the particular corporation, and they will sum up all of their sales from all those business operations, and then they'll minus off the cost of the goods that they sold during the year, and then that'll equal the gross profit. And then you'll add back in then any net gain or loss. And this can be net gain or loss like a sale of business property. You can also have gain and loss from stocks, interest income. It could be rentals and things. And then that'll equal your total income. And then you'll minus off these various deductions. And those are deductions mainly for your inputs into your business. And those are things like your payroll costs, interest that you had to pay, rental or lease payments that you had to pay, again, to run your business, and depreciation. And this is really key as far as understanding, again, this linkage between the federal tax policy and what Oregon then transfers here. And as we saw with the bonus depreciation issue at the federal level, this is where it came in. Then what we saw was when the federal government changed the bonus depreciation laws, then that fed through as a larger negative then for corporations as far as being able to take a bigger portion of the depreciation in a given year. And then what they transferred then in net business income to Oregon then was smaller. So that is the connection, and we still see this connection both as we were talking on the personal income tax side. This is where you see it on the business income tax side. So just recognize this is why those federal tax changes are having an effect in Oregon on corporations, because they start at the federal level consolidating all of their income, but then they get various deductions, and these deductions are then transferred through, and they become a result then of the business income that they transfer and apportion then to Oregon.
So, Elizabeth,
mm-hmm.
We see a feedback in 0305 on the bonus depreciation, or do you know if we'll start to see some feedback?
Senator Decker, yeah, in the model that we have feedback coming back, because really with the bonus depreciation, it's kind of like a delaying of the depreciation. So in the outer years, you know, it really is a positive. So,
Mr. Chair, one of the things reduces the feedback effect in Oregon is that if you're a multi-state company, your national income is apportioned back to Oregon. So you don't have to invest in Oregon to get that bonus depreciation. It's just because, see, it comes before the apportionment actually takes place. So there you get a federal bonus depreciation plus a state bonus depreciation. But again, if you're multi-state, if you could invest in Arizona, it would affect your Oregon apportioned income.
So how significant is the projection for from the bonus depreciation? Or is it just too early? And
Senator Deckard, it's not real large. I mean, as far as I'm thinking, around 5% or so.
5%.
Yeah, I really have to look at the numbers again, and we could give you that impact again if you want it. But.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then as we're talking, we're going to transfer this net business income that the corporations will arrive at the federal level, and then it's apportioned to Oregon, and then you also apportion any net operating losses and net capital loss deductions also. And so that is brought through to Oregon here. And then that arrives at the taxable income for Oregon, and then we apply a tax rate of 6.6%, and that is applied uniformly. It's just a flat tax of 6.6% to the net income there. And that then comes up with the total tax before credits.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Is there a minimum tax, minimum corporate tax?
Senator Ringo, there is. It's $10.
It's the filing fee?
Yes.
What do other states have for a minimum tax, or is the filing fee the minimum tax in every state?
Senator Ringo, I don't know what all the different ranges are of the minimum tax in other states. I mean, I know it isn't only $10, so.
Mr. Chair.
There we go.
Is there ever a minimum tax stated in terms of percentage of one of these figures, whether it's a net business income, gross receipts, any measure like that?
Well, Senator Ringo, you could look at that, but you'd also want to consider the reason why you're having it is for those corporations that don't have any income. Okay, so, you know, in all these other, you're basically assuming here that all these other business income, and after you take away their operating losses, that they have no taxable income. So then they're just paying $10. So that's why it's kind of become a flat fee. And now you could make it like flat and then, you know, make it a certain function of the taxable income if you want it. But that's the reason why it's a flat fee.
Thank you.
Okay, now this just kind of gives you a range here and an understanding and perspective of Oregon's flat corporate income tax rate of 6.6% in relative to other states. Now, these other states that I've listed here, there's 31 states. I just put the states here that have a flat tax. And there's quite a few states. The majority of the states have a flat corporate tax. There are some that have progressive tax structures, but this really just kind of gives you a good snapshot that where you see Kansas is down here at 4%, and it ranges all the way up to Pennsylvania that has a tax rate of 10%. Now, Oregon in this case is like 19 from the top, so we're 19 down, and we're like 12 from the bottom in this list. And when you looked at Oregon's corporate rank in 1999-2000 for corporate taxes as a percent of personal income, we were ranked 18th. So, you know, you can see this really, you know, even looking at these different flat taxes among states, it does give you a pretty good indication of where Oregon's going to be ranked. And again, a lot of that's because, you know, this corporate income is arrived at the federal level and is portioned to different states. And so, again, all these states, you know, they don't have a whole lot to do to make themselves, you know, real distinctly different because they're all just getting portioned.
Senator Hannan.
The states that you show up there on your map, and mm-hmm. I was just looking here, how many are comparison that have so-called three legs of the stool and versus Oregon that only has basically the income tax as a comparison against funds that are generated in your map up there? Are all those incomes?
Senator Hannan, yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, you know, like how many of these don't have something.
I'm trying to find out what are you trying to compare their Oregon to. Oregon to Pennsylvania is number one at 10%. Is that 10%, that's their state tax rate?
Senator Hannan, that's correct. Yeah, just like Oregon has 6.6%, that's what's applied to that net income that comes from
corporate. Well, when I hear people say Oregon is the second highest in the nation on tax, and then I look around and I say, well, you're showing Oregon right there in the middle of the scale, and 6.6 compared to what? What is else taxation does Pennsylvania have that's number one? Do they have no property tax? Do they have, is there no income tax that is comparable to that rate? Or is there no sales tax that is comparable to that rate? I mean, comparing them to what?
Well, Senator Hannan, first, you know, when we're talking about the rank of two in the nation, that's personal income tax. Right, not corporate.
Right.
Where do we rank in corporate?
I don't know.
That's what I just said. 18th.
Overall, combined everything.
Okay, it is in your book here. It's
6% of our taxes.
You've got the ranking.
What's number 10 book you're looking at?
I don't know.
Number 10 what?
We don't know what book here.
For income taxes is a percent.
Okay, this is your
tax burden.
Well, I grabbed the wrong one, but it's the one that's the Oregon Public Finance Basic Facts.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So in there, there's the ranks of the different taxes here in Oregon, and the one we're ranked second in is the personal income tax as a percent of personal income. So what we're ranked here in corporate is we're ranked 18th of corporate tax as a percent of personal income.
Do you, Mr. Chairman, if we can, do you have a comparison on what the population is of those states? Now, you look at Pennsylvania, it's a substantially larger population state, but then you look two up from Oregon there, and there's Arizona. Arizona is fairly comparable to Oregon in size of population. So I'm trying to figure out what kind of high-tech or what kind of businesses corporate-wise are in Pennsylvania that are so highly taxed versus Oregon that is only at 6.6.
Well,
do you have any comparable comparison on something like that?
Senator Hannan, yeah, I don't know all the different industries, you know, and the makeup that there is. But, I mean, I think your point about, you know, which ones have only two legs of the stool versus three, I mean, I think these obviously are all states that have income taxes because they have corporate
mm-hmm.
taxes. Okay, now, like, say, Washington isn't on this because Washington doesn't have an income tax, but they only have two legs of the stool.
But they have a business occupation right. tax.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, these states that are listed here for corporate, are these the only ones, is Washington the only one with a business occupation tax?
Oh, Senator Hannan, you mean all throughout the U.S.? No,
yeah.
There's other states, Michigan.
So how does that figure in their equation when you look like Pennsylvania, let's take Pennsylvania, it's the top rate there. It's got high corporate rate, but what other kind of taxes does it have in comparison to other states that don't have some equal taxation? You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, Senator Hannan, but I think it really, you know, you would need a much more comprehensive examination,
yeah.
I mean, to just look at all the different taxes that each one of these states have, and that's not really what I was trying to do with the graph. It was more just giving you a snapshot because I know people sometimes just want to know where our rate is relative to other states that also have income taxes, and that was really all it was meant to do. And it was just, to me, it was kind of interesting to note that our rank, corporate tax as a percent of personal income was 18th, and we're, you know, 19th from the bottom there, or, you know, 19 down. So it is kind of interesting. But, you know, we can look at those kind of issues in more detail if you want, you know, as far as researching, you know, the various states and all the different taxes.
So everyone's lights are on. We'll start with Senator Farioli and work our way left.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just making notes with my colleague here from the Legislative Revenue Office. It really depends on how far you want to peel the onion back. The different rate is only part of the equation for net tax. You start with a definition of income, and that could have a whole different set of credits and exemptions for each state. And it does. You get a definition of income that's a process, and it's a formulaic approach, and every state has a different formulaic approach. And at the other end of all that equation, you're going to have different credits, different exemptions, different nets for taxation. So just expressing corporate income taxes as a percentage doesn't tell you how they get there. So the problem we have with comparisons is 50 states, 50 systems. Two-legged stools, three-legged stools, four-legged stools, one-legged stools. It really depends on how much detail you want to give yourself. But, you know, controlling the net revenue to the state means controlling two sides of the equation. What do we call income, and what are the deductions and credits off that? And that basically determines the net, and then you multiply the net by a rate. So if you don't look at all those equations in a comparative way, you're really just focusing on one statistic and arguing about it. Senator Hannan's discussion about 2%, or we're number one, or we're number two, is exactly dead on. Number two in percentage of total reliance on income tax is the source of the general fund. That's what we're number two in. Number 18th in the rate that we apply to corporate taxes, but you have to look at how we declare income. And if you've looked at corporate income taxes, you realize there's an awful lot of deductions, and it takes you far afield from what your federal gross income is, even on your state individual tax form. So I bet we could spend a couple of days just doing the comparisons on four pieces of the equation of how you get the net tax in corporate excise or corporate income taxes.
Mr. Chair?
We're working left. Paul, and then your third in the queue.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add a couple of things to Senator Hannon's comments that about the state. So the state we do look at because they don't have a sales tax is New Hampshire. They, of course, don't have not only a sales tax, but they don't have a personal income tax either. So you'll notice that this is in New Hampshire, they call their BPT, which is their business profit tax, and you can see they're up near the top of the list. They also have what we call a BET, which is a business enterprise tax, which is a value-added type tax. So that they've gone with a value-added, very low rate, 0.25% rate, and then the business profits tax. So that's really, they kind of have a unique system to get there. The other comment I would make is on the Washington's business occupation tax. That shows up in all of these statistics as a sales tax. It's treated as a sales tax by the census. So they just tack it on top of Washington's retail sales tax to get an effective tax rate as a percent of income. But Senator Farrell is right about the rates. These can vary a lot by the base that you use, but that's why we get back to our other number that's in your basic facts, where we take corporate tax collections and divide by total personal income for the state, and that's where Oregon ranks 18th.
Okay.
Senator Starr.
I'll pass to my good colleague to my left.
Okay, so we're going to go Ringo Starr. Senator Ringo.
First time anybody said that.
You're kidding me.
Now I know why this place got moved.
We've been talking about the corporate income tax burden. There's a statistic out there about the overall tax burden paid by businesses in our state, I think, as being either the lowest or the second to the lowest. And obviously that would consider businesses paying property taxes in our state versus other states, sales taxes, applies. But is that the figure that's in that other book that you mentioned? The overall tax burden paid by businesses?
Senator Ringo, no. No, it's just all total taxes. That's a percent of personal income.
Do you know what is Oregon's ranking in terms of total business tax burden?
Senator Ringo, I don't know.
Is that number available somewhere?
Paul?
Senator Ringo, that isn't something that comes from the census, because that requires assumptions about who's bearing the burden of particular taxes.
Yeah.
And as Elizabeth has shown, we have a lot of businesses who pay the personal income tax. So you've got to make some assumptions about what proportion of the personal income tax is really business. For our estimates, it varies right about 12% or so, between 10 and 15% over the years. There is a study that comes out, and I think it's every other year or every year, from the Utah State Tax Commission that we have participated in for the last 10 years or so, and it compares the 12 western states, and I can get the committee that's the latest version of that. That does show Oregon with the lowest business tax burden among the comparison group in the West.
That's 11.
Is it, Paul, is that the figure that I think Chuck Chekatoff's group refers to? Is that the number?
It could be, Senator. I'm not sure exactly, but that's the study I'm familiar with, and I'd be happy to make that available.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You're on again.
You're ready? Okay, now let's just talk real briefly about the corporate tax credit.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask you to regress for just a second.
Senator Farrelly.
And back to the previous chart. If you look at the brackets, there aren't 18 brackets there. There are 14 brackets there. And if you take a step back and look at whole percentage brackets, there are only 5 points between 6 and 10. It's, you know, 6.6. If all the 6 infractions are a single bracket, and all the 7s are a bracket, and all the 8s are a bracket, and all the 9s are a bracket, and all the 10s are a bracket, there are really only 5 categories with fractions there. I'm just suggesting that there is certainly a difference between Pennsylvania and Oregon. But if you look at the pack that we're in, you know, we're not that far from all of the other brackets from 8 down. I mean, there's only really a few states in that bunch. The spread looks like a lot when you're doing 1/10 of a percentage point changes between states. But effectively, we were pretty close to the top in that regard. If you just look at the number of different brackets there are, and you know, consolidate the nines, consolidate the 7.9s, the 7.5s, and the 7.0s, and you sort of move up the total number. If you went up just 1%, you'd be in the top 10. So it's a we can look at statistics, but they can be a little bit misleading.
Okay. To talk real briefly about the corporate tax credits that are used, in 2000, there were $35 million in corporate tax credits, with the largest being the pollution control credit here. And with the pollution control credit, it's allowing then a credit up to 50% of the cost of the pollution control facilities. The investment must be certified by DEQ. And in 2000, there were 100 taxpayers that benefited from that credit. And you can see that research credit, which is basically looking at giving a credit for 5% of the amount of research that is over a base amount of the qualified research in the state. And these, and the research right now is limited to high-tech fields, the field of advanced computing, advanced materials, biotechnology, electrical device technology, environmental technology, and straw utilization. So the research credit is pretty highly used at 24% of all of our corporate tax credits. I'm sorry?
How many utilize that?
How many utilize it? Oh. Yeah, Senator, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's a few hundred. Yeah. So the next kind of large one there is others, which is really mainly insurance credits, and these are credits that are paid for taxes that the corporations pay to other entities. And then you've got, like, the business energy credits at 7%, where this is basically a credit for investments made by businesses for use of renewable energy projects and, like, recycling projects. And this credit is equal to 35% of the cost of that certified cost of the project. And that's been taken 20% each year over 5 years. And then besides that, you've got some smaller ones. You've got, like, low-income housing there. And with the low-income housing, this is a credit against corporate income taxes for the lending institutions that are actually making a below-market interest rate to be able to build low-income housing projects. So the credit is the difference, then, between the finances that charges that would be incurred at the market versus the finance charges are actually incurred at the below-market rate. So then that becomes the credit amount. Now, with the farm worker housing, this is allowed for owners of farm worker housing that are going to construct new housing, and it's 50% of the eligible cost of the construction. And then with dependent care, that is for businesses that are providing dependent care assistance to their employees, and they're allowed 50% of the total cost of the employer paid for those dependent costs.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Before you leave there, on the pollution control credit, what is the price tag on that?
Well, this one is roughly $9.8 million, but that's what it was in 2000.
And when is that due to expire or sunset? Wasn't that a sunsetted issue in the last session?
07.
It goes till 07?
I believe.
Senator Hannah, in the 01 session, the sunset was, I believe that's right, was extended to 07, but the program was modified as well.
And
those eligible were modified. But whatever changes, the program is set up so you've got a 10-year tail on it. So you DEQ will certify a program or an expenditure, and then that credit is spread over 10 years. So you have the credits now reflect the decisions of the past decade.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now just to kind of go through some of the key points with the corporate excise tax, we have a unitary reporting requirement, and this was basically adopted in 1984, and this requires that the businesses that are operating in Oregon and filing a federal consolidated tax return must file then a consolidated return here in Oregon. And the consolidated return is basically just combining the income of any of the affiliated groups of corporations. And the related corporations that are included in the return have to be considered to be an intricate part of the unitary group's business. And Deborah will go into a little more detail on this requirement. Now, the multi-state business income then is apportioned to the various states where the corporation does business. And again, it's only the business income that is apportioned. Now, the S corporations, that income, as we were mentioning before, that is, they do not pay an excise tax beyond the minimum tax, but they will pass through their income, and then their shareholders will be paying a personal income tax on that income that they get from their business. And then, again, the minimum tax is $10, and this is paid by both C corporations and S corporations. Now, this graph here tries to give you a bit of an understanding of some of the changes that are going on within the C corporations. And this shows you between 1990 and 2000, the multi-state corporations' percent of the total returns, that's what the yellow bars are, and then the blue line here is the multi-state corporations' income as a percent of total income. Now, as you can see, in 1990, the multi-state corporations, they made, you know, roughly 23% of all of the actual returns. So that's not really so many returns. And it did grow over the next 10 years, so that by 2000, you had probably about 32% of all of the total returns were multi-state corporations. But the big change here was this blue line here, where you can see here that the multi-state corporations, their percent of the total income was only about 70% in 1990, but by 2000 it was over 80%, about 85%. So this is just really showing the trend then in our corporate excise tax as far as such a large portion of that tax, you know, 85% is now being paid by multi-state corporations. And this just again breaks down the C corporations by Oregon-only corporations versus multi-state corporations. And when you're just looking at the returns, what you see here is that the returns that have losses, you know, 70% of them there are Oregon-only corporations versus 30% that are multi-state corporations. And this is also true between 0 and 100,000 in income. And you start seeing a reduction there where you're seeing less Oregon-only corporations, so it's only about 45% between 100,000 and 500,000, and the majority then are multi-state corporations. And then you see that between 500,000 and a million in income, those corporations are really only about 20% or less Oregon-only corporations. And then as we go up from a million, you can see that percentage of Oregon-only corporations drops. And then when you look then just at the corporate components breaking up their net income into Oregon-only corporations versus multi-state, you see in the losses there, you do have a few big multi-state corporations that have losses. And so you have, of the income, you have a few big losses there in multi-state corporations. So you have about 25% that are Oregon-only, about 75% of that loss of income is from multi-state corporations. But then you see it flip so that between 0 and 100,000, that's primarily just Oregon-only corporations, where you got about 75% of the income between the zero and 100,000 is from Oregon-only corporations. And then you see it starting to drop off. Between 100,000 and 500,000, you see there's roughly about 42% that are Oregon-only corporations versus the 58% that would be multi-state. And then again, it drops off between 500,000 and a million above. You can see that's only about 20% or less are Oregon-only corporations. 80% are the multi-state corporations.
Elizabeth, have we seen any more positive trends than what we saw over the summer and certainly last year in terms of our C-corporate multi-state returns?
Senator Deckard, no, I'll show you some numbers of what we've seen in estimated payments, but no, it's not looking real good yet.
Yeah.
Okay, now this just briefly gives you a summary then of both your seat of your Oregon-only and your multi-state corporate tax returns and then the net tax in 2000. So again, as we see the 2001 turns starting to come in and we see the estimated payments, clearly we're going to have there's a real big drop here from tax year 2000 where there was $375 million in net tax versus what we're going to be seeing now in 2001 tax year. But just to give you an understanding again, what you see here is you had a total of 36,648 returns, but the large majority of those returns there were those that had losses. And so once you see that that the loss category comprised the majority of the returns and then it fell off, and then when you got out to above a million, it's just a very small number of corporations that are actually in a million and above income groups. But as far as the amount of tax that is paid, again, as the amount of income goes up, then so does the amount of tax that is paid until you see that the majority here, you've got over 33% of the tax is paid just by those corporations that are in the 25 million and above. And that's what this is telling you here. Now, in response to Chairman Deckard, your question about corporate payments and things, that's what this graph will kind of give you, again, an indication of. We saw this same graph on the withholding side, on the personal income tax side, but now this is the corporate excise tax estimated payment. So these are the payments that come in four times a year. We have estimated payments in April and June and September and December on the 15th of each of those months. And what this is looking at estimated payments for a year period. So the beginning base here where it's one is September of 1998, and it's reflecting 12 months of payments from September of 1997 all the way up till September of 98. That is the base of this index here, and this index begins at one, and then once we see the changes in these various industry sectors from the September of 1998, that gives us a sense of how the industries are doing. Now, when you look here at the black line here, that's all the different sectors together here, and you can see that, you know, all corporate income tax estimated payments, you know, we're rising from September of 1998 all the way until you hit about April of 01. Okay, then once you hit April of 01, you see this black line starting to fall. Okay, and this really just, you know, gives you an understanding that, you know, that this really helps you in seeing on a monthly basis how all these estimated payments are really reflecting the environment in these different corporations. And the green line here, which is obviously quite volatile here, but this is the manufacturing, okay? And this is really an important thing, you know, industry to be looking at for Oregon and understanding what changes are going to be occurring in the excise tax payments. You can see between September of 1998 and all the way up here till its peak here in, you know, probably March of 2001, you saw that manufacturing sector had grown threefold. I mean, that's basically what an index of three means, is it tripled in size. from its original 12-month period of September 1998.
The green bar, really, I mean, that is why you have five special sessions.
That's right.
Is that green
right.
bar right
and
there?
And it dropped.
It's July.
You know?
It
and again,
July.
Yeah, and when you look at this timing, this was all before the forecast. I mean,
yeah.
you know, this is, we based our forecast on, you know, March of 2001, you know, information. And at that time, we didn't even have this data. Mm-hmm. This was not available. The Department of Revenue has been, the research, Craig Fisher's staff has been working on this data and making it available to us. So this will really help in the future as far as giving us a monthly snapshot of, you know, basically where are we with these different sectors. And mm-hmm. and estimated payments are much better at showing the you know, things that the environment that's going on in the different corporations versus withholding, where you may not get as good a sense there, because if people aren't laying people off or if they are not actually reducing their hours, then you're not going to see real big changes in the withholdings. Mm-hmm. But estimated payments, you're going to see it sooner because people are anticipating what their profits are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very good indicator for us in the future to be able to help us in forecasting. So as you can see, most of these bars are below one, which means that we, you know, most of these industries have not recovered since even to the level of September of 1998. And now this next slide here shows you the industries, again, broken down in a little more detail, that really have been hit the hardest. And these are the ones that had more than $1 million in decline in their corporate payments between July of 2001 and November of 2002. And obviously, as we saw from the green line there, the manufacturing had the biggest. It was $114.4 million in reduction in their estimated payments. That's a 98% reduction. Management of companies and enterprises, and this is really a lot of withholding companies who estimated payments really are depending on the health of the corporate industries in the state. And so this was $22 million below, 90% drop. Information, which is like media, this is like $15.7 million drop, or an 84% decline. Wholesale trade dropped $15 million. Finance and insurance dropped $12 million. And again, ones like finance and insurance, we're really talking about big insurance companies. We're getting then some of the different net profits that they're seeing all throughout the country. And so these kind of, you've got to recognize with corporate estimated payments, it's not only what's going on in Oregon, but many times what's going on in other parts of the world. And the finance and insurance industries were hit hard in 2001. And transportation and warehousing, it was a reduction of $5.6 million, 70% reduction. Construction, you know, about $2 million, 20% reduction. Mining, $1.7 million. Real estate and rental and leasing, $1.4 million reduction. And accommodations and food services, $1 million. So now I just want to go through a few examples, and these are meant to be really simple, just to kind of make sure everybody is clear on kind of the procedure and a real basic example of how the corporate excise tax and the apportionment portion really works. And again, we're just looking at business income here that is apportioned, and business income is defined as the income that is arising from transactions and activities that are in the regular course of the taxpayer's trade or business. So we will be excluding then the non-business income. And this apportionment formula is really just an attempt now to measure the level of activity that is occurring in the state and by the corporations, and most states are using a three-factor formula where it's payroll, property, and sales. And then this weighting of those factors is what is so much debated now. But generally, to just make sure everyone's clear again, you have to have nexus in order to tax that and receive income from those different, the payroll or the property or the sales in the state. Now, nexus is occurring if you own and lease property, so if you have an office area or a warehouse or a plant, if you have capital or property employed in the state, also if you have employees and personnel in the state, then that can establish nexus, and it also if it derives income from activities within the state. Now, basically, when I'm just going to go through and talk briefly about some of the apportionment formulas, and again, I'm going to give you a comparison of different states, but there's a lot going on among states, and so it's not, you know, a real clear where states many times will just fall into one category or another. But there are 47 states that have some corporate income tax, and then you've got 14 of them now that are using the equally weighted formula. And when basically from about 1957 was when the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act really formally adopted and really recommended an equal weighted formula apportionment in 1957. And so really that was used by most states from 1957 till about the 1980s. And so the majority of the states were using this equally weighted formula. But beginning in the 1980s, then states did start to migrate towards an apportionment formula that was placing greater weight then on the sales factor. So that's what we see now, is we now only have 14 states that are using just equally weighted formula. We have 26 states then are using a double weighted sales, and you've got five then that use 100% sales. And then you've got some that are using a hybrid between 50% and 90% sales, or a hybrid system. Now, Oregon right now is in the double weighted sales category, because we have a sales factor of 50% and the payroll and property are each 25%. But beginning May of 2003, we will move down here into this hybrid category, because we will have a sales factor of 80% and then a payroll of 10% and a property of 10%. Huh. Now, here's just a breakdown then of the different states. And some of these states are in there, have two different X's, and the reason why that is just because there are some exceptions going on in different states where different industries are given the opportunity to use different apportionment formulas. So, for example, you've got here in Colorado the option of using an evenly weighted two-factor formula. You don't have to have all three, the payroll in there. You can just have sales and property. And in Connecticut, you've got certain manufacturers that can maximize to elect just using a gross receipts, meaning this 100% sales factor formula. In Louisiana, you've got manufacturers and merchandisers and others that don't have any specific formula they have to follow. They can just choose which formula they'd like to have. And then in Maryland, you've got manufacturers that use, again, the 100% sales formula. And in Massachusetts or Mississippi, you see retail service companies which have a one-factor sales formula. And again, manufacturers that are selling at retail, then they have the three-factor formula with double-weighted sales. And in Oklahoma, the corporations that are meeting then a certain investment criteria are allowed then to double weight the sales factor. So I think that the important thing to recognize now is that it's not always clear cut that there's going to be one apportionment formula even for each state. There can have different exceptions for different types of industries. Now, this is just an example here of making sure that we kind of just go through a simple calculation of just apportioning then business income. And there's two main requirements, again, to be met in order for the state to have the right to apportion any income to the state. And first of all, the corporation has to have nexus with that in that taxing state. But it also, the corporation is not protected under the public law 86-272. And these are activities that are serving no independent purpose besides just to solicit orders. So the important thing is that we, and Deborah will talk about that in more detail, but there are conditions in which you may have just soliciting of orders going on and sales in that state, and then you wouldn't have an actual nexus with that state. So in this example, we've got Oregon and we've got California, and we've got a payroll and the property and the sales. And what basically the payroll factor there is telling you, this amount of $12 million is telling you that there's $12 million spent by this corporation A in Oregon on their personnel costs there in the state. And then in property, this is the value of all of the corporation's real and tangible personal property owned or rented within Oregon. And in this case, it's $20 million. And then the sales are just telling you again the total of all the sales of all the members of the unitary group in Oregon. And these are against two Oregonians. And this is $20 million here. And so the total, and then you just total up all of the different payroll, property, and sales amounts. And then you, then to figure out the factors, then you're going to be taking the portion of the total that's in each state. So in this case, payroll, you divide 12 divided by 40 to give you 30. So that gives you 30% of all of the payroll of Corporation A is going to be apportioned to Oregon. And 40% of all the property is going to be apportioned to Oregon. And 20% of the sales will be apportioned to Oregon. And then you average those three of property, payroll, and sales in order to get then the average amount. In this case, in Oregon, it's 30%. So Oregon gets 30% of the business income versus California, which gets 70%. And then if you take the total net income for the corporation, say it's $5 million, and you take Oregon's $5 million, you're going to take the total corporations of total net income of $5 million times 30% gives Oregon's portion of $1.5 million. Now, then you just take that $1.5 million that's been apportioned to Oregon, and then you multiply by the tax rate of 6.6% to get $99,000. Now, in this particular example, we have looked at payroll, property, and sales all being equal, just calculating a simple average, like they all had 33% of the total. So that's, you know, the simple example of where all the factors are equally weighted. Now let's look at what happens then if you have a double-weighted sales. And this, again, is the same description of the amounts of payroll, property, and sales in Oregon and Washington. And what you do differently now is you've just got different weights here. It's not evenly 33%, 33%, and 33%. You are going to have to then calculate a portion of it because you're weighting the sales twice as much as you are the property and payroll. And again, one of the things that is kind of causing some states to move towards more of a heavier weighted sales is because that does create an incentive then for corporations to want to invest in manufacturing in the state. You've got a payroll that's, and also like maybe they set up a call center or something. Again, that's payroll, so that is something that is, you know, would not be as heavily weighted, so then their tax burden would not be as large as if it was all equally weighted. So what you're doing is trying to encourage additional investment in property and payroll when you're heavier weighting the sales. Now, as you can see here, when you're heavier weighting the sales, we come up with 27.5% of the total that Oregon would be getting apportioned of all the net income of the corporation. Oregon gets 27.5, where before, as we saw in the previous example, it was 30%. Okay, so then, and California is getting a bit more. It's going from 70% to 72.5%. So then when you do this, you're getting the $5 million again, then you're timesing 27.5, so you get a $1.38 million as far as the amount of income that is apportioned to Oregon versus the $1.5 that you got before. And California is getting a larger amount of income apportioned to California. And again, when I'm giving you these examples, I'm giving you both, you know, states are moving, you know, to double-weighted sales. It could be such that the California would stay at its equally weighted sales. So, you know, I'm just showing you it, given the relative, if you assume that they both are moving in one direction, then this is what would happen. And what this tells you is that this is that the state with more sales moving to a double-weighted sales will help improve their taxes as far as increase their taxes that they're getting because they're getting more income apportioned to them versus the other state like Oregon, which may be smaller and have less sales. So we see we went down from 99,000 down to 90,750. And then finally, like I was talking about, Oregon is going to move now to a super weighted sales, you know, the hybrid system where you're going to have 80% sales faster. Property will be 10%. Payroll will be 10%. And that, again, will be happening May of 2003. And what this really is showing you is, again, you're moving from 27.5% of the total net income to 23% when you have then this weighting more heavily on sales. And again, California is benefiting in this case because they have so much more sales relative to Oregon in this example. And again, the total income is $5 million, and then you're going to multiply that by 23% to give you $1.15 million. And then when the tax, you're going to take the $1.15 million times 6.6% to give you $75,900. So what we can see in the short run from these examples is that if you have two states, obviously they're moving in the same direction as far as more weight given to sales, then you can see a drop then in the revenues of the state that has a small amount of sales. But the long-term impact, really, from moving to a more heavily weighted sales, it's really going to depend on the corporations that are in your state and how they are reacting to your change in your apportionment formula. Are they going to invest a lot in payroll and property in your state as a reaction to your change in apportionment formula? Then in that case, you could be seeing a real big increase here in payroll and property in the state. But, you know, time will really tell, and that really does depend on the corporations that are in your state as well as new ones you may be attracting in. But also the other thing you have to consider is, what are the other states doing in reaction? Are we seeing a big progression then to more super weighted sales? I mean, we've already seen that over the last 10 years. More states are moving to more hybrid systems and more 100% sales. So then in that case, if you think the end result is all states are going to be moving eventually to, you know, a large, heavily weighted sales, then states like California that are big, that have a lot of sales, then obviously they're going to be, you know, benefiting from that because that brings in additional revenue for them. But it's just a matter of the time period and what kind of, how quickly all this happens. You know, do corporations really take advantage of the fact that now they only have a 10% factor of property and 10% payroll in Oregon? And so it still, you know, remains to be seen what the, you know, feedback effects will be for this. And then finally, I just wanted, this is not the easiest thing to get into, but I did want to just make sure everyone was clear on what's the sales throwback rule, because here in Oregon we do have the sales throwback rule. And basically this is a rule that is trying to make sure that it applies to a state when basically the purchaser has no right to tax the seller. So on most cases, we have the destination rule, where if you manufacture something here in Oregon, say you manufacture furniture, and you have sales that are going to be sent up to Washington State and to California, well, then the destination rule applies, where those sales will get allocated to the state in which those sales are actually going to be, where their customers are in the destination state. But what the things that can happen is when your destination state is not taxing those sales, then that's when the sales throwback rule can come into play. Now, I give in this example of Washington State. Okay, that's a state that doesn't have an income tax. So when sales are going to, when you've got that furniture that's been manufactured here in Oregon and it's sent up to Washington State to fill those orders up there in Washington State, well, those sales are not getting taxed in Washington, so then they can get thrown back here to Oregon. And you also can have a situation like a state like Idaho, where if for some reason you don't have nexus, that the corporation doesn't have nexus with Idaho, then those sales can get thrown back then to the state that manufactured those goods. So in this simple example here, again, we've got Oregon and California, and those are the same factors we were having before. But then you've got Washington in here, which has got a small number of payroll, and then you've got sales of $15 million. Okay, so the question is if you had no sales throwback rule here in Oregon, then those $15 million of sales that went from your manufacturer here in Oregon would escape taxation then, that $15 million of sales. You can see here that the average then, when you would calculate these factors, again going 12 divided by 42 to give you 28% here and on down, then you can see that in Washington there's no income tax, so those are not taxed. then you've only got 94% as far as the total. That is not 100%, so that means some sales are escaping taxation. And so with the sales throwback rule, then what happens is if that manufacturer is here in Oregon and you're filling orders that are going up to Washington State, then those sales then get thrown back then to Oregon. So that $15 million in sales in Washington gets added then to Oregon sales. So then Oregon sales are 35. And then we see that these get then the factors then get increased from 17% to 30%. And then our average is bumped up here in Oregon so that the average with the throwback is 33% versus the average with no throwback of only 28%. So then this obviously brings in a little additional income then to Oregon, $7 million if you have a net income of a total of $7 million times in 33%, gives you $2.31 million, and then a tax of $152,460. So I guess the main thing to think about and remember is the sales throwback rule really becomes more of an issue now that when we're looking at the apportionment formulas of different states, and as we're applying more weight now on sales, then sales become more important to states. So the sales throwback rule is becoming a lot more of a debated issue. You've got, I think, 26 out of 47 states that actually have that sales throwback rule. So this is something you may see in legislation in the future. So that's really it. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you very much. Any questions? I'm just shocked that Senator Corcoran, you've been eyeing this day for so long that you have no questions or comments. But
I
will just continue on. Thank you very much.
Senator Corcoran moves that we increase the corporate income tax.
I've been keeping Elizabeth busy with all kinds of other tax schemes.
Deborah, I think we're going to close out the day with a brief presentation from yourself.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for staying with us. And
you're very welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. You've had a lot of information already, so this should be fairly short and, I hope, succinct. Lizbeth talked a lot about nexus and the requirement that a corporation have nexus with Oregon before we can impose a tax. And one reason this is such an interesting area and sometimes a challenge is that we don't have a bright line test for establishing whether a corporation has nexus with Oregon. It's very often a facts and circumstances kind of case. But if a corporation does have nexus with Oregon, then we can impose the corporate tax on that. So let me just get started here. Nexus, again, is the connection that the corporation has with the state. And if a corporation is doing business in Oregon, then we are able to impose corporate excise tax on that corporation. If you look at this example, we have a business in Idaho, headquartered in Boise. Their factory's in Idaho. All the sales are occurring in Idaho. Logic would tell you Oregon doesn't have any right to tax that corporation because they are not connected to Oregon. So what happens if this particular corporation starts engaging in activity outside the state? They make sales outside the state. Perhaps they start sending some people outside the state. The question is, how much activity needs to occur in Oregon before Oregon could impose a tax? In looking at that, we have two constitutional provisions that need to be met. We need to watch out for the due process clause, which says there must be a minimum level of in-state activities before the state can tax the corporation. So there has to be something going on here. And then the income apportioned to this state has to be rationally related to the values connected with the taxing state. So what you ask is, what has Oregon given to this corporation that gives us the right to ask for a tax in return? That's the due process clause. The other one is the commerce clause, which says the state can't interfere in interstate commerce. There has been at least one case that laid out four criteria for looking at a state's tax. And it said if it has these characteristics, the tax will be upheld. So if it's applied to an activity with a substantial nexus with the taxing state, if it's fairly apportioned, if it does not discriminate against interstate commerce, and it's fairly related to the services provided by the state, then the tax would be upheld. So if we look at this example, this corporation now is not just engaging in business in Idaho, but they have a warehouse in Oregon. They're shipping product into Oregon. They're making sales in Oregon. They've set up an office in the Willamette Valley. Clearly, this corporation now would be taxable by Oregon as well as Idaho, and the income would be apportioned between the two states, as Lizbeth talked about.
So what's the standard that they have to meet? I mean, there seems to be ambiguity in the due process. Is there a set standard that they must meet? Or?
Mr. Chair, there is no bright-line test. You look at each on a case-by-case basis, which really points up the challenge for us in administering this, is a corporation logically would not necessarily want to have nexus in a state. It may be making sales into the state, but if they can avoid having nexus with the state can't tax them. So the corporation is going to try to structure its activities so that it isn't taxable, and of course the state is looking at that to say maybe your activities are a little more than what you think they are, so we think you should be taxable, and that's where it gets to be a challenge. In this example, if we back off from that last one just a little bit, you notice the office building is gone and so forth. So here you have the office in Idaho, the factory in Idaho, sales in Idaho. But what's happening in Oregon? They're sending salespeople into Oregon, and they're making sales in Oregon. So this brings up another point that needs to be considered. Not only do you have the Due Process Clause and the Commerce Clause, but there was a federal law passed in 1959 to protect corporations that are engaged in just this activity. And what this says is if a corporation limits its activity to simply soliciting sales of tangible personal property, that activity does not create nexus in a state. So here you have the Idaho corporation that's sending salespeople into Oregon, shipping product into Oregon from outside the state. They don't have nexus with Oregon, and Oregon would not be able to tax them in this case because they're protected by that particular federal law. Again, you'll note on this one that services are not a protected activity. So again, this protection, this federal protection, only applies to solicitation of sales of tangible personal property. So then we have the question of what activity is the corporation engaged in? Do they have this protection? And there was one case that the Wrigley Gum Company had asserted that they were protected under this law when they sent salespeople into stores. The salespeople were not only soliciting sales, however, they were also pulling stale gum and restocking with fresh gum. And the court found that that activity was enough to remove the protection of Public Law 86-272. The company then had tax or nexus in that state and was taxable on income apportioned to the state. So again, this is an area where the corporations are careful about their activity, depending on whether or not they want to have nexus, which brings up another point. And that is, this is a gray area, as, again, there is no bright-line standard, so reasonable people can differ on the interpretations, which means that you could have a corporation engaging in activity in Idaho and Oregon. In filing the Oregon return, they might claim that they have nexus with Idaho and push the factors into Idaho. In filing the Idaho return, they may say, we don't have nexus with Idaho, so we're not taxable in Idaho. So you get an inconsistent position in each state, and yet it's such a gray area that you can make the argument both ways. So that can happen as well.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr.
Is there opportunity for Idaho and Oregon to compare notes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, actually we can share information with the states. The problem, of course, is being alerted to that in the first place and realizing that perhaps you need to share some information there, but we do have information sharing capabilities with other states.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So has there been any analysis of what the level of behavior like that is? I mean, is there any measurable way to see if you have a problem or don't have a problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I'm not aware of any. I would expect someone is doing studies on that, but I don't know about them.
Okay.
I could try to find out if you'd like.
Well, I mean, it's sort of like the cigarette sales stuff, you know, where if it gets too great, you start looking at, gray market and that sort of thing. And I'm just curious. I mean, I don't have any suspicion that it's a big problem, but I don't trust corporations, so I assume it probably is.
In talking about Public Law 86272, there's a list there of things that are not protected activities. So when a corporation engages in this type of activity, that can create nexus. If they approve or accept orders in the state, again, under the public law, those have to be approved and accepted outside the state. If the company comes in to install a product, that's not protected. If they make repairs or provide technical assistance, we might see this, for example, in computer sales. If you have a computer company that's located outside the state, but they're contracting with another company here, and there's an agency relationship there, that could be enough to create nexus, and so on. Now, let's go to another example. This is the Oregon Corporation, your homegrown, home-based Oregon Corporation. Offices here, it's sales here, it's factory here, no activity outside the state. Clearly, this is taxable by Oregon and not by any other state. So what happens when this corporation starts to engage in activity? The same sort of rules apply here if they're just shipping product outside the state, if they have the salesperson going to Idaho and soliciting for sales of the tangible personal product. They don't have nexus with Idaho. And this is the picture that you might want to keep in mind when you're talking about the throwback rule, because this illustrates what Lizbeth was talking about. This corporation, because it does not have nexus with Idaho, is not taxable by Idaho. So under the throwback rule, the sales that would be apportioned to Idaho are thrown back to Oregon. So the basic, simple policy question for you under the throwback rule is, should 100% of the business's income be taxed by the states, not just one state, but the states? If you did away with the throwback rule, in this particular case, those sales would be thrown out of the equation, thrown to Idaho, and less than 100% of the income would then be taxed by the states. So that's really the question when you consider throwback rule. And moving away from nexus to unitary versus separate reporting, Lizbeth talked about this a little bit. Most states use either a combined unitary reporting or separate accounting. Oregon uses unitary reporting, which means that the separate legal entities are ignored and you look at the business as a whole. You look at whether the two corporations are providing value to each other, rather than considering this to be a corporation and this to be a corporation and separate the income out that way. So, for example, if you use separate reporting in Oregon, which we don't, but if you did, this is what it would look like. You have that Oregon corporation reporting its income to Oregon. You have the Idaho corporation reporting income to Idaho, and they're not combined, and the income is not apportioned. So you can imagine that there would be an opportunity here for some income shifting. If Idaho has a significantly lower tax burden than Oregon does on corporations, there would be an incentive to somehow push the income to Idaho, push the expenses to Oregon, and separate it out that way in order to lower the tax burden. Instead, Oregon says, look at the whole thing, look at what's going on with the entire entity, take their combined income and apportion that between the states. And in fact, the advantages and disadvantages, unitary reporting, again, can minimize that shifting. It is a little more complicated from an administrative standpoint because we need to determine whether or not you have a unitary group, who goes into that group and who doesn't come into it. And that's sometimes a challenge. Again, no bright line test here. Separate accounting, on the other hand, can be simpler, but it does give you that income shifting opportunity. And the South Carolina Jeffrey case is an example of a state that has separate reporting. In that case, a corporation was set up and there were intangible assets shifted to it in an attempt to move income outside the state. The South Carolina Supreme Court said that was not effective, that they had nexus and so on, and the U.S. Supreme Court did not want to take that opportunity to resolve the question, but with unitary reporting, we've tended to avoid that just a little bit. So when you look at the big picture and consider that these corporations are not engaging in business just in Oregon and Idaho, but they're engaging in business throughout the United States and around the world, and we need to look at those issues and try to consider what needs to come to Oregon, then those are some of the challenges that we face in our job, and it is so much fun for people. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We especially appreciate pictures on this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's very helpful.
I do try to avoid numbers as much as possible.
Questions?
We used to get crayons to do a color in their things. They don't give us that anymore with the budget cuts.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrelly.
Only Senator Corcoran was getting the crayons. We didn't tell the other members.
That's a game. Last session.
The game was not high chair.
Okay, we might as well shut
this
committee down.
Well, we've got about
down.
30 minutes. We could keep this running. Thank you, Deborah. This concludes our major informational portion of the Revenue Committee. We will next week, and you should get our schedule for next week,
I think, tomorrow.
This afternoon.
Oh, this afternoon. Great. So that'll give you the schedule for next week. We have a lottery bill next week, and we'll include a brief orientation on the lottery as we do the bill. But we're mostly into now a few reports that emanated from last session, and then the coursework of our revenue committee. Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've gotten, over the course of the last year, a slew of emails about the comprehensive annual financial report. And the comprehensive annual financial report is the report of reserves held in various state agencies against anticipated future liabilities. The amount aggregated and reported in that comprehensive annual report is about $58 billion. And taxpayers who've heard that Oregon is sitting on a mountain of unobligated money of $58 billion are asking me, do I know about the fund? Shouldn't Oregon be releasing these dollars back to taxpayers? Shouldn't these dollars, in fact, be used to pay our current obligations and eliminate this shortfall that we're currently in? I think it would be helpful to have the Revenue Committee present or to have the Legislative Revenue Office present the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report in very brief form, indicate where these dollars are, what they're for, talk about the obligations of the state, why these reserves are necessary to be held, and give us something that we can share back with constituents. At least in answer to the dozens of emails that we are getting about this treasure trove that's buried under the Capitol ground somewhere, and in fact just dispel a lot of misconceptions about what our obligations are and why these reserves exist.
And invite Kaferman or whatever it is to come and sit in on the hearings.
Well, I don't.
The website.
Mr. Chairman, I don't necessarily care about any particular proponent of.
It's because he's from John Day.
Raids on the reserves, but I do think we owe citizens clarity and to tell them why we got the reserves and where they are and what they are.
Mr. Chairman, I might suggest that a courtesy copy be sent to Lars Larson so he understands what we're talking about, too, because he apparently spreads this rumor daily that we're sitting on $11 billion worth of assets that we could balance the budget if we only looked at it.
Kaferman!
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. I think that would be valuable and in some ways maybe disseminating the information at least to folks who have either in the media or other places that have taken an interest in this would probably be worth our time and effort also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, just another comment. If you could just help with this committee shed some light on that and put it into perspective, you'd be doing a public service.
I agree.
If you did find the $58 billion, you would be such a hero.
Wow.
Everybody just, that would be the end of the session, wouldn't it?
Nobody would be elected.
Yeah. So either way, we need to take a look at it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Paul, did you...
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we talk with the Controllers Division who produces the report. And having looked at it and worked with them over the years, that they have a different set of, an entirely different set of principles, accounting principles, than is used for the general fund and the other fund budgeting budgets that you're familiar with. So I think they could probably explain those differences and the principles they use to develop that report.
We will schedule it.
We won't go after the principal. We'll just go after the image.
Senator Ringo.
I'll pick fast.
That then concludes your Senate revenue. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you Monday.